And we are back with episode 804 of The Critical Myth. I'm John, your host, and tonight we have...
This is Gary from Jacksonville, and even though I didn't watch any of the top three shows, I still thought it was a good TV week.
Yes, that's, I'm sure, going to make things a little bit interesting as we get into it, but hey, I can say that Edmund did give us his comments on those episodes, so at the very least we will get his feedback and his insight. Yes, this is all the episodes from the week that ended the 2nd of May, so we are pretty well caught up now. But yes, before we get into any of that episodic discussion, Gary, if you could give a disclaimer.
Yes, hopefully you've had a chance to watch all the episodes that we are going to either lightly touch on or go into great detail on. Once again, we don't apologize for any spoilers. We want to openly discuss these shows and don't want to be shackled down by not having to reveal or discuss key details. So consider yourself warned that we will spoil any and everything if necessary.
True, true. And yes, we're going to go ahead and get right into it by mentioning that there were 22 episodes this particular week, 21 of which we have scores for. So yeah, it's starting to get a little bit more... the list is getting a little longer again, but that's how it goes. And why did that not take... Sorry, I just realized that there was a score that I needed to put in there. Okay, didn't change anything though. As we go through our bottom three, yes, there were a few contenders for the bottom three because there were a lot of episodes with a similar score, but we did pick them based on some commonalities, shall we say. The first one on the list here is Class, Series 1, Episode 3, Night Visiting. The ghost of Tanya's father visits and requests that she bond their souls. Okay, that's an interesting request. This came in at a 7.5. Yeah, again, this is one of those episodes that's really designed to give you a lot of insight into the characters and where they're coming from and some of their traumas, but instead I was really just left wondering how that kind of invasive situation would have taken place with absolutely no one other than this group of teens doing anything about it.
So Unit doesn't show up or anything like that?
No, it really made no sense. Because literally, I mean, eventually you'll watch this, but the entire freaking area of town is just... strewn with these weird, like, alien tentacles everywhere. I know that the Doctor Who universe is distracting, but it's not that distracting. Somebody else should have noticed this. Also on our list for our bottom three here is Doctor Who, Series 10, Episode 3, Thin Ice. A frost fair begins, but revelers begin disappearing beneath the Thames, and Bill and the Doctor try to intervene. Yes, both Edmund and I gave this one a 7.5, and Edmund said, still not gelling for me, getting a little tired of the machinations of breaking in another companion, starting to feel like we've been here before. Yes, that's exactly how I feel about it. And again, I'm just going to repeat, getting a sense of Bill as a companion, really hard to do, it seems, this time. I have a feeling, unfortunately, that this 10th series of the modern era is really just us waiting for... The next Doctor,
you mean, or the end of the series?
The end of the Capaldi era.
Okay.
All right. I think we're all just like, yep, we know that what's going to happen, that he's going to move on to a new incarnation, so now we're just waiting for it to happen, unfortunately.
I've been there for a while, John.
Yeah, I'm sure you have. Yes.
But I'm sorry to see that. Now, I didn't catch this episode, but as Edmund says, it's not gelling. Is it the companion and doctor's relationship not working, or is it the individuals? What? Because, you know, both are important.
I think it's that, and I think the stories that they're telling are a little bit familiar. And I think that's because they don't have... I think, really, at this point, Moffat needed to move on. And unfortunately, I think that not having a big story arc in place or a big... I can't say that they don't have a big storyline in place. They probably do. But to me, last series, where, for better or worse, we knew that Clara was moving on, I feel like they did a much better job with basing the entire series around the kind of slow but steady sense of dread that moment was coming, and that it was almost self-imposed, and it was this self-fulfilling prophecy that it was going to take place. And I don't get that sense this season. I really don't know where they're going yet. Which may be what they're going for, but it's not giving me a whole lot to sink my teeth into. unfortunately, at the bottom of the list here, a little bit of a surprise, but maybe not so much, considering that this show has been kind of disappointing in its third season. The Flash, Season 3, Episode 20, I Know Who You Are. Barry and the team meet Tracy Brand, a scientist who may be the key to stopping Savitar. And this came in, as I said, at 7.25. Gary, you gave it a 7.5.
Yes, I like the doctor part of it. I thought that was an interesting plot line to explore, that she was going to make a revelation that she hadn't yet to trap Scimitar. And then I just had to start deducting like mad, because the idea that Barry's going to be Savitar, I just screamed no. I just don't get it. Did they run out of people to throw into the villain suit, and Barry was the only one around? I can't imagine what would bring Barry to that point, that he becomes his own tester, so to speak. Or this whole idea that Zoom was, like, you go back to earlier seasons where Zoom is trying to get Barry ready for something. Is this what he was trying to get him ready for, to be Savitar? I just sort of scratch my head. It just doesn't seem to make sense. Plus, shouldn't he have evaporated into the Speed Force before Savitar actually happened? In which case, I'm trying to keep track of all the different plot lines and time windows and all that, and it just gives me a headache, like on the left side above my eye. So, it just did not ring true for me. I just didn't see it, and I don't like it. And please come up with some other solution. Maybe Thrawn's looking like Barry. I don't know, but I don't think that's the case. But I don't know how they're going to pull this off, but I was let down with the revelation. Were you excited about it, John?
No. I gave this episode a 7. I wasn't all that thrilled. I think that Savitar's identity was literally the worst kept secret since, anything that you can think of. Who didn't guess that that's who it was? I think that they were really trying to be clever. And it was about as hard to guess as the identity of Dr. Alchemy.
Well, there was I did actually have a little bit of doubt when with the previous episode when they went to the future and the other Barry knew but didn't want to say. I thought maybe it's somebody I don't know then. That seemed to be a little iffy for me. But obviously that was incorrect.
And I just have to say that battle between the Flash and Killer Frost, with her running around, was just
You mean with the Iceman Bobby. Like
yes,
running ice carpet.
Yeah, the
wow, that was a quick skill to learn, wasn't it, John?
Yes, that and it was also incredibly bad effects.
Yes.
That didn't help either.
But I actually think Danielle Panabaker pulls off villain really well, though. I mean, all special effects aside, she really seems to thrives in this role. So I'm enjoying watching her in it. But yeah, I agree. The that was a really cheesy effect.
It really was.
But that's why it's at the end of the list. So
that's correct. And unfortunately, I really feel like they need to take a huge step back between seasons and rethink this whole idea of, let's just keep beating this drum with timelines and time travel and speedsters and so forth. There has to be a different way they can go.
And it's not in the comic books, his sort of, I don't know if specialty is the right word, but it's that his variety of villains that he has to go against, not all this time stuff that they seem so wrapped up in lately. It's the diversity of characters that's typically the hallmark of a Flash story, not the, and villains in particular, not so much this whole time travel frame thing. That's I'm not saying it doesn't exist, but it never used to take on this level of importance.
Yep, I agree. So that's the bottom three for this week. So sorry, just got mildly distracted with an editing issue. We can now move on to our top three. And the first one here in our number three slot is Better Call Saul, Season 3, Episode 4, Sobrosito? Sobrosito? Whatever.
Jimmy calls good.
A favor from Mike. Edmund gave this one a 9, and let's see if I can actually read this one well. The Gus Fring story swings into full view, and it's great seeing Giancarlo Esposito sink his teeth into this character again. Meanwhile, Jimmy ropes Mike into helping him start to dig out of the hole Chuck wants to toss him into. Machinations galore, gloriously done. Okay. I'll I'll buy it. It's one of three shows that came in at a 9 this week, so it's really a three-way tie in our top three. Mm. Crazy, isn't it? In fact, one might call it crazy white fella thinking.
Oh.
Yes, that's our number
much like the episode of yes. Leftovers, yes. Yeah.
Yes, this is our number two show, The Leftovers, Season 3, Episode 3 of that particular title, coming in at an average of 9. Let's see if I can get through this particular description. As the departure anniversary approaches, Kevin Garvey Sr. is inspired to wander the Australian outback in an effort to save the world from apocalypse. Not the apocalypse from X-Men. That would be a complete plot twist. But just generally his, at least, understanding of apocalypse. Both Edmund and I gave it a 9. Edmund saying, very interesting deep dive into Kevin Sr.'s walkabout, with the star of that film showing up as well. Lindsay Duncan was extraordinary in her devastating confession. Yeah, that was actually a really great scene. For me, I really was surprised at how focused the episode was, that you got the sense of how warped Kevin's father's perspective was, and now we're starting to see why the various hints about Australia in the promos are kind of going in that direction. Australia's role in the final arc is clearly going to be substantial. So I'm waiting with great interest to see where that goes. That brings us to our number one show for the week, and that is The Handmaid's Tale, Season 1, Episode 1, Offred. So, the series premiere of a drama about a fertile woman who is forced into sexual servitude in a dystopian society with a plunging birth rate. Oy, that just only slightly touches on what this is about. Also getting a 9. Edmund says here, amazingly vivid depiction of an oppressive world. Drags you in and keeps you on tenterhooks the whole time. I completely agree. And as adaptations of classic novels go, this is exactly as terrifying and revealing as it should be, and it feels all too timely considering recent events. Yes, I'll go there. No, this is one of those shows where you're watching it, you understand that this is really extremely good and well-made storytelling, and you're not comfortable one bit of the experience, but you're not supposed to be. And going in knowing that, you can really kind of dig your teeth into it and try and absorb some of the feeling that it's trying to invoke. So.
Well, I'll definitely add that to my list. I wasn't sure. It almost looked like it was set in like colonial times from some of the previews. Is it, or is this? Did I not understand it?
No, I'll give you a little bit of a background on it. Essentially, it is a near future where the effects of the environmental change and a specific. I don't want to necessarily get this wrong, but there is something specifically that happens that renders the human birth rate to drop precipitously. Okay. Basically a plague of infertility. Uh-huh. And so in the wake of all of this happening, a very highly fundamentalist religious government takes over. And if you are a fertile woman, you are pressed into service as a handmaid. And their whole function is to be a servant to rich, privileged, married couples. And they serve the purpose of bearing children.
Yes.
And really, they don't have a choice. And those who resist are very harshly treated. And a lot of it is clearly invoking the idea of a religious government gone incredibly out of control. And very pointedly, it's not that the world goes this direction, but rather that this is where the country goes. Because some people are trying to get away from the country to, like, flee to, say, Canada and other places. But that's in keeping with the novel, which was very much kind of written during the years of the formation of, say, like, the Moral Majority movement. And kind of saying, where could this lead? And because of certain, you know, recent events, there are some who say that this is kind of evoking a lot of the same kind of paranoia and existential terror that the novel kind of brought to bear during those times as well. So it's timely in that regard. You know, obviously, being a male in today's society, I can't exactly relate to what's going on in the screen. But it's hard not to be pulled into the compelling dilemma and horrible situation that they're in, and understand kind of the underpinning of what the author was trying to say. So it's not, like I said, it is not an easy show to watch. You're very uncomfortable watching it, but at the same time, part of that discomfort is recognizing that the seeds of that world are not necessarily as buried as one would like to think. They are very front and present. So a really good adaptation of the novel, to say the least. Let's see here. Anything down here on the list, then, that you would like to explore?
Perhaps, yes, let's see. Yeah, I'd actually like to talk about something that made a bit of a bump up this week or this episode around. Let's talk about the episode 7 of Iron Fist.
Okay, just give me one moment.
No problem. It came up from the bottom of the dredges, and so I think we should reward it a little bit.
Jumped up a bit, and that would be Iron Fist, Season 1, Episode 7, Felling Tree with Roots. Ward's... Oh, you did get the name right. Ward's loyalty is tested. Danny finds a rogue division. The strange Bakuto visits Colleen's dojo without notice. Okay. And this one came in an average of 8. Yes, and I kind of already gave my thoughts about Iron Fist in its current incarnation last episode. But you liked this episode quite a bit. You gave it an 8.5.
Yeah, like I said, it's still on an upward trajectory for me for this episode. I love to see Ward falling apart. And at the end of this episode, it appears to me that he's killed his father pretty darn well. And gosh, that really sort of shakes up a lot of dynamic and what I would assume or what seemed to me to be a lot of support for Danny through the father. So it seems like things might be going different than I was assuming they were going to go at this point. We see this whole 13th floor hidden in the building. So wait a minute, maybe every building's got a 13th floor. I'm going to count from now on. But that's that was interesting that the hand has not only are they involved intimately in the Rand Corporation for delivery and delivery purposes, for storage purposes, but they even have a whole dedicated floor in their office building just for them. That's kind of creepy. I enjoy how things are getting shaken up a little bit. You know, last episode we did have Danny doing what he assumed was the correct and honorable thing, where he met the head of the hand, or at least their representative, agreed to fight. And then at the end, they were dishonorable and changed the terms of the fight. And we're starting to realize that, parts of this world are, different, and that maybe the old ways aren't going to always fit. And I think that was, that was interesting as Madam Wu, Madam
Wu?
Wu was talking about
Gao,
Danny.
How, actually,
Gao. Yes, Madam Gao. Thank you. And how she was talking with Danny about at least what she perceives as his motivations for leaving Kunlun, and this idea that maybe he came back to just be Danny. And it's a very interesting, almost tempting, seductive offer, the way that she's saying it. Go to your hotels, go to your restaurants and eat fine food, and leave us alone. And because she has this sense that maybe he abandoned Kunlun and just to come back as Danny. And we start to realize that maybe the place to defeat the hand was never going to be Kunlun, and at least that's what I'm taking from it, so that he is actually in the right place at the right time to fulfill the prophecy. And so I didn't think he took it to heart, but I don't think the actor's portrayal sort of gave you enough of a reading, honestly, which is frustrating about his performance. Secondly, we have this mysterious guy come to visit Colleen's dojo, and gosh, it's very odd, and geez, I hope he's not Hand either, but feels like he belongs to something else, and she's definitely has loyalty to it, definitely above her slight relationship with Danny at this point. And so that leaves me scratching my head, what the heck is going on there? I also enjoyed the idea that Danny was ganged up with the other, I'll say Yakuza, but I don't know that it's actually that, with the other Asian groups that is telling you the hand's going to kill you in a week. You might as well come and fight with me. And I liked how he was able to rally support for his cause. I found it nice because typically, you know, he just played this clueless guy for so many episodes, and now he's starting to be wise to the way the world works, and he's turning his own gears rather than just getting, you know, thrown through them. I'm enjoying that development, and I wish they'd speed it up, but it is there nonetheless. We now have this mystery with Colleen. We have the guy who used to make this drug dead, and hopefully, as best I can recall, never actually did give them the formula, so that they're already going to be in trouble and sort of have their backs against the wall, at least. So I think they're definitely creating an air of tension and stress and a boiling point for the episode. And it's just going to ramp up as far as I can tell going forward. So I'm looking forward to it. I don't know what's going to happen with Ward. Joy, I'm still sort of scratching my head about. I don't know Colleen's loyalties at this point. The hand doesn't keep their word. So I don't know what they could do or not do. And it's, I really enjoy how it's shaping up. That and Danny obviously has a very competent secretary. Good for him.
I suppose so.
Well, she finds everything he needs. She even has changes of clothes for him in the closet. So, yeah, so it works out for him. But, yeah, I see it continuing to improve. As I say, my biggest hurdle is still the actor himself. I don't feel that he plays the role correctly, but I try to overlook that and sort of focus more on the story and the other characters. And that's been holding up pretty well for me.
Yeah. Try, like I said last time, try looking at it and his performance, and even the way that the character is written from that whole perspective of he's kind of living in an 80s ninja movie.
This episode, more than any other one so far, I can definitely see echoes of what you're saying. Especially as he brings the group together to go fight with him at the place. And I definitely saw your point with that. Yeah. It's like I said, it's shaping up. It's good. I said 10 episodes, I believe. So we're
13, about, I thought.
Oh, 13. Oh, so yeah. We're
halfway.
We're in the home stretch, starting to get in the home yep. downhill now. So that's good. I wish they had gotten to this point around episode 2.
Yeah, that would be nice, right?
Yeah.
Okay, let's see. Next on my list that I would like to get your thoughts on is the Supergirl season 2 episode 19. Alex. Alex is kidnapped, and the kidnapper threatens to kill her unless Supergirl releases a notorious criminal from prison. This one came in at an average of 8.17. And, yeah, I think, you know, we both gave it an 8. Henry gave it an 8.5. He says Supergirl's move to the CW has meant that this season took an unbalanced turn towards indulging its romantic side. So it's refreshing for this episode to change the character dynamics, or rather tweak them in a certain way. And, yeah, I kind of felt that way, too. How about you, Gary? What was your reason for going with an 8 with this episode?
The premise just struck me a little odd and concerning about people knowing her real identity, and if the guy was willing to actually, you know, spoil it or spread it doesn't take much with the internet nowadays. But it's just I've seen this premise in comic books, Superman comics in particular, a few different times, and even in Batman comic books. It was just a little bit of a little tropey for me, so I know that knocked it down in my opinion. As far as Henry's thing saying that it wasn't a romantic episode, I thought Alex and her girlfriend were very romantic and touching, and through with the sacrifices they were willing to do, and their, and the talks over the, I guess the webcam, and in the reunion when they actually got free, I thought it was, I thought it had many romantic moments in it. So I can't say there was a dearth of them by any means. Also, this is this continuing issue we have with Kara being impulsive that is still not going away. I guess it's a hard character trait that they really won't have her ever give up or learn her way out of, that she wants to punch and fight her way through everything. It seems sort of odd for someone who came sort of late to these powers in her development. Meaning she was about a teenager, I guess, I guess 12, 13 when she came to this planet. So you would have thought that maybe that fighting response wasn't in someone from Krypton like that. But nevertheless, it's here and it's showing itself yet again that she's impulsive and causing problems and sped up the time frame for her sister to get killed. And it's an ongoing issue with her, which for better or worse, there it is. I like that they continue to try and use John as some sort of stand-in character for somebody. But again, a lot of people don't seem to fall for it as this guy did, which I thought was a fun scene. My dad would never say that. Oh, crap. So that was an interesting scene. And generally, it does show how superpowers don't always can't always save the day by themselves. And I thought that was a nice message to show as we reach these Kryptonian power levels in National City here, as opposed to say something like Star City, where you do have more ground people sort of without amazing powers solving things. It's nice to see that you do need regular people like the police force and stuff like that. And I enjoyed Alex's girlfriend's discussion on during the hostage crisis, how, oh yeah, they call it the Supergirl clause, I think she actually said, how, you know, a lot of people get off because they don't get due process and, mm-hmm. and they're hurt and stuff like that. And it's nice to have that touch of reality in this typically not quite real world of Supergirl. It's much more fanciful than Arrow is, by all means. And it's a good point to think about it in these superhero universes, how our existing right structure, you know, is not conducive towards vigilantism. So it's I found that to actually be a chunk of wisdom thrown into what some people might consider a a soft episode.
Popcorn show?
Yes, thank you. Bubblegum, I think. Yeah.
Yeah. I get exactly what you mean. And yeah, I also really appreciated that particular plot point. Any other shows on your list here while we're getting close to wrapping up?
Let's see. We both saw this one, so I think this would be a good one. And it was I thought it was a great episode, personally. Why you despise it so much, I don't know. But I'd like to talk about Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.
Okay, Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., Season 4, Episode 20, Farewell, Cruel World. Daisy and Simmons rush to get the team out of the framework, but not everyone is ready and willing to leave. And this one came in an average of 8.67. And Edmund and I both gave it an 8.5. He says here, an excellent escape from the Matrix, framework. I'm wondering if Ada's new toy will tempt Mac to resurrect his daughter, although its Darkhold origins probably mitigate against that. Strong setup for the final episodes. Yes, it is, actually. I loved the fact that they kind of recircled back to the Darkhold. I'm not necessarily wondering about Mac and his daughter. I'm more interested in thinking, hey, this would be one heck of a way to get Ward back on the show.
That was my thought exactly, John. I was definitely thinking that. I'd love to have that happen. That'd be great, and it'd be good Ward.
Yes, exactly. It would be a really nice way to kind of, again, bring it all full circle. I have the hiccups. And
oh, no problem. Although the one thing that I didn't quite understand, and I'll assume, of course, it's Darkhold related, how is Ada able to teleport with Fitz at the end?
Yeah, that was I definitely took that as having been related to the framework, or rather the Darkhold.
Okay, I hadn't seen that before, though.
No, I either. Excuse me.
Okay, and, I just wanted to make sure. I was like, did I miss something somewhere? When did? Anyway, I realized they had to. I understand the purposes of immediately extracting Fitz from his friends, given the mental state that he's in, and he's so broken up over all the things that he did while he was in the framework that. I could see him definitely being, I guess, manipulated by Ada, given the relationship they had in the framework, and now he feels so horrible. So he's definitely in flux, which is a nice place to have him in, although he really is the Chekhov of the series, I feel.
Yeah, that's true.
He seems to get hurt or get the short end a lot in this. I mean, I guess they were playing it pretty obvious that, Mac would have issues, but it still surprised me that he did stay back in the framework, that he didn't leave. As I was thinking, oh, great, we can have the whole team back and maybe Ward too. I guess it didn't shock me because it was somewhat telegraphed, but I thought he might have still jumped through at the end or something like that. So we'll have to, see what comes of that. But I thought this was a great way to – I guess it didn't quite end the arc, but definitely ended the framework part of the storyline to have everybody come back. And when Coulson went through first, and he's almost encouraging May, come on, May, let's go, come on, make the jump. It was really interesting. I sort of had doubts whether she would have been the first person through or not after that. But she did come through, and that was nice. And you definitely see their relationship is stronger than ever. And it was there were issues sometimes with what happened in the framework, I thought it was a very successful gimmick and a nice way to freshen up the series a little bit.
Hmm. Mm-hmm. I would agree. I just don't know exactly where these last two episodes are going to go.
Oh, I know. I mean, I don't know. Is this going to be a save Fitz? Is this going to be a save Mac? Is this going to be, like you said, could it be Mac's daughter that comes back? Or Ward, or both of them, or neither of them. And then, you know, then there's still, the framework still exists. So what happens to that? Do you keep that away and make it a prison for people? Do you destroy it utterly so nobody can ever go into it again? Lots of places to go with that. So.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Okay, let's see. We still have a few moments left here, but I think I'm going to go ahead and run down these. And if we have any comments, sure, we can jump in with them. Okay, we talked about Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., but we have iZombie, Season 3, Episode 5, Spanking the Zombie, was given an 8.5. American Gods, Season 1, Episode 1, The Bone Orchard, was given an average of 8.25. Edmund here saying, I'm really enjoying this so far and being a lifelong Ian McShane fan. I got Mr. Wednesday in Who Do You Worship online quiz, naturally. Okay, interesting. Not sure what that means, but all right. I'm thinking an he meant that as he got Mr. Wednesday in an Who Do You Worship online quiz. But okay. Yeah, I really liked it too. It was a surprisingly good adaptation, and I'm really looking forward to where it goes from here. The 100, Season 4, Episode 9, DNR, got an 8, as did Riverdale, Season 1, Episode 11, To Riverdale and Back, and The Originals, Season 4, Episode 6, Bag of Cobras. Into the Badlands, Season 2, Episode 7, Black Heart, White Mountain, got an 8, as did Outcast, Season 2, Episode 5, The Common Good. The Americans, Season 5, Episode 9, IHOP, got an 8, with Edmund saying, great to see Martha again, but I continue to feel underwhelmed with this season. Kimmy popping up out of nowhere reminded me that they've been saying Philip and Elizabeth are stretched too thin, but not showing it enough. Yeah, it seems like they're spread so thin that the writers don't even know how to cover everything. Arrow, Season 5, Episode 19, Dangerous Liaisons, got a 7.75. Supernatural, Season 12, Episode 19, The Future, got a 7.5. Prison Break, Season 5, Episode 5, Contingency, got a 7.5. And finally, Designated Survivor, Season 1, Episode 18, Lazarus, came in at a 7.5. So that's it for that particular rundown of episodes. So any last thoughts, Gary, for this week's worth of discussion?
Well, I guess we could touch back on how we began the episode with some of these, with the lowest of the three, or at least the bottom three, especially the Doctor Who. I don't think we've ever rated Doctor Who towards the bottom three twice in two weeks in a row. That's really shocking to me.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. I mean, it's, just the fact that it's coming in where it is really quite surprising. And I'm hoping it's just early series jitters, and that as more plot points start to pop in and so forth, that we're going to get a better sense of where things are going and a brighter appreciation for these characters. But I really feel like there's a little bit of a something lacking in the mix right now with Doctor Who.
Now, I mean, I hear the Moffat naysayers. I've been hearing them for years now. But you were mentioning earlier, you were thinking it was like maybe time for him to go. Do you feel he's sort of burned out his ideas as he's revisiting scenarios or things that have happened before?
It could be, or it could just be that it's hard to say. I think that really they need to, the way that it should be, and maybe this is a little bit of a harsh way to look at it, is that I feel like, you know, Davies, it made sense for him to be the guy for 9 and 10, basically because 9 was just a one-off, and then 10, really, the Davies era was 10, right? I mean, the 10th Doctor is pretty much his definitive Doctor. And I feel like Moffat did a really nice job and a definitive job with 11. I think 11 was the Doctor that he was so focused on. I think he's done a well enough job with 12, but I really almost feel like 12 could have benefited from having a different showrunner. Mm. And it might be, and some people may disagree, but it might be that they should have a different showrunner in charge with each new Doctor. Let the change in the actor also be reflected in the change in the tone in the writer's room. And just, I think it would work better that way, because I think some of the problem is that it took a while for Capaldi era to get geared up, because it was, unfortunately, you know, kind of, there had been a dynamic established between 11 and Clara, and then 12 had to come in and try and figure out how to establish it for the new mix there, and I don't think it quite worked as well as they had hoped it would until it really hit its stride last season. I think there's only really been the ninth series was the one that was probably the definitive one for Capaldi's era. Even now that we're in the beginning of 10, I think it's easy for us to say that. I feel like maybe you don't need to be quite as decisive with the companions, but I think that a lot of people felt like it might have been better to hold off on Clara until 12, just so that that dynamic wouldn't be compared against the relationship between 11 and Clara. I really felt like Amy and 11 should have ended at the same time. I still feel that way. And I feel like going forward, it should make sense that you have the Doctor, the companion, and the showrunner. I think they should start, as unfair as it may seem to Bill, I think that they should start off the new era clean slate.
Well,
if that makes any sense. I think the 13th Doctor should have their own new companion, and to go along with the new producers and the new show running voice.
Well, I would suggest that you write the BBC and let them know.
Well, from all the rumors that I've heard, they've already gotten the message, so.
Oh, okay. Well, that's good.
Yeah.
I'll be waiting for the new showrunner this week.
If Bill had been a really strong and just super beloved companion out of the gate, I might have felt differently. But considering the fact that there seems to be a very big difference of opinion with her, and for a lot of people, I feel like she's going to wind up being a one-season companion.
Mm.
And it sounds like the BBC wants to kind of have a fresh start with the new showrunner next series. So, and in fact, I think that there's even a push for it to really show up as early as the next Christmas special. So, we'll find out.
Geez.
But all that does is it makes me feel like this is like a lame duck season. And that's unfortunate. I don't think it should be that way. I felt the same way with 11 when we knew that it was the last season for 11. And it was like once they wrapped up the whole Amy arc, it was like, okay, whatever they do with Clara is going to get wrapped up big time in the whole 50th anniversary thing. And we know that that's going to be the end of the 11th era. And now it's just this big event thing. And even though it worked out pretty well, and in at least a couple cases, we really liked the material that came along, it still was like lame duck writing to a certain degree. It was like, we're just waiting to see how you're going to end this era and move on to the next one. And that's, I really feel that way right now. I feel like we're marking time, and I don't like that. I feel like I should be more engaged in exactly what's going on in the material, not in seeing the seeds being sown for the next era. If that makes any sense.
Yeah, no, it does. It makes a lot of sense. So we'll see. But yeah, he's been running it for several years now, and some fresh blood might not be the end of the world. So
it really wouldn't. Especially
with Doctor Who, it could be the end of the world.
Yeah, good point. But I think that, you know, let's face it, Moffat has gotten a lot of criticisms, and I think it's time that, you know, somebody come in new and see if those criticisms can be mitigated, you know, given a good reaction, however you want to put it. Addressed.
Yes.
Let's put it as addressed. I don't know how, but in some way, shape, or form. How about you? Any other thoughts here? Certainly, I hope that next time we can talk about Guardians of the Galaxy in a little bit more detail.
Oh, yeah. No, that would be nice. I'm trying to think. It's interesting that that so many of the DC properties are currently not reaching the top heights that they had earlier in the year. So I'm not sure if that's series fatigue, that they've run out of good ideas or not, but it's interesting that they all seem to not be up there anymore.
Yeah, it really does, and that would be a discussion, a worthy discussion, maybe for next time, of just the... I know that Edmund had said a few times that he felt like there was a bit of franchise fatigue taking place, and I really feel like it's worth asking the question, did they expand too much too fast? And have they bit off more than they can chew with the Arrowverse or the DCW or whatever you want to call it? Because, yeah, when it was just Arrow and The Flash, it felt like that was... that could have been enough. Have they overdone it? Are they asking too much of the audience to try and watch all of this material and keep up with it, and for it to be fresh in for themselves is hard to imagine that they would say that right now they are keeping all these balls up in the air.
Yeah, it definitely feels like it's bearing down on them, so to speak.
Yes. Almost like they need somebody to go back and give them a little bit of a flashpoint moment to rethink things.
Well, as he said in song, he's not supposed to do that anymore.
That's right.
So.
All right, well then, we're going to go ahead and wrap this up for today and for this particular week. So thank you everyone for listening in, and we will be back next time. So until then.
And so ends another epic episode of The Critical Myth. If you want to leave a comment for this show, head over to vognetwork.com. Not only can you find links to the podcast version of each show, but there is a dedicated forum, a ton of written reviews and related articles by the crew throughout the site. For the written reviews, you can even leave your own review, so let us know if you agree or not. You can also leave comments on our Facebook page, Critical Myth, on Twitter at Critical Myth, or Google+, under The Critical Myth Show. Any and all use of copyrighted material is only intended for discussion, commentary, parody, or educational purposes, in accordance with U.S. Code Title 17, also known as Fair Use. In other words, please don't sue us. And of course, the statements and opinions of the Critical Myth crew are not necessarily those of the VOG network, its partners, or affiliates, but let's face it, we're probably right anyway. Until next time, watch, read, and listen, and believe in the critical myth.